This week on the show, food trucking on Twitter, Google's Uber Alles monoculture, and the new visual vocabulary of 3D. All this on This Week in Media, episode 192. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I am your occasional host, Daisy Whitney, because I have kind of been an every other week host this summer. I've been busy with a lot of conferences and travel. I was in LA last week at the NAPI LA TV Fest where I saw my co-host, Tim Street. Hello, Tim. How are you? Good to connect with you again.
Yeah, always, Daisy. It's always funny to see you in person. Like, I'll see you just for a second at a conference, and then you're gone.
I know. It does. Yeah, it does seem to be that way. As our listeners know, I run into Tim pretty much everywhere, but we truly are. There's ships passing in the night, because I'm usually kind of touching down and, you know, then running around and doing 7 or 8 interviews and then, you know, heading off to the next place. It sounds terribly glamorous, but I assure you, it's not. It is fun, though, and I'm glad to be able to do it. It's good to kind of reconnect with the TWIM audience. And I think I'll be on for a couple weeks before I wind up traveling again. We also have Lon Seidman on the show from Local Online News TV in Connecticut. How have you been, my friend?
I am great, except my internet is down, so I'm in a supply closet right now, but it's okay.
See, that is how dedicated Lon is to the cause. You know, he got himself over to a utility closet just to do this show.
Telling you, it has to happen. Gotta get it done.
Oh,
did you upset your cable company?
Probably. I gotta go back and check my tweets.
Yeah, say some nice things about Comcast now. And we also have in Los Angeles as well, we also have David Bloom, who was on the show a few months ago, and now he is back. David is just one of my favorite people in the entire world. I'm thrilled to have him on. He's a consultant in communication strategy and digital media, and just, you know, one of the smartest and savviest people I know about the media business. How's that for an intro, David?
I will send the check right after the show.
All right, let's get started by talking about AntennaGate. So this was obviously the big story late last week. There was the press conference on Friday. So basically all phones are bad is kind of the conclusion, it seems. David, let's start with you since we haven't had you on in a few months. What was your impression from reading about and reading the news reports on you know, Steve's conclusion about the iPhone 4 antenna problems?
Well, I think that from the standpoint of somebody whose background is as a communication strategist, that they mishandled it. I mean, the lesson to be learned in this new era is you get on consumer complaints fast and aggressively and prominently. You don't shine them on. You don't do a Toyota. You know, Apple has profited hugely from the intense devotion of its fans, and I don't think they serve their fans well. I don't think the issue itself is that huge, but the way they handled it sort of diminished people's concerns. Now, it's interesting because there was a piece in Forbes today that pointed out, you know, that one of the things that they did when they finally came out with their response was to say, well, we're not the only ones. All cell phones have problems. And they showed some video of some of the other companies. Well, three of the companies shot back. But as Forbes pointed out, they were sort of non-denial denials. And that's absolutely true. I mean, they said, well, we designed around all this stuff. But they didn't say, no, you're wrong. We don't have problems. They just said, we didn't do a design like you guys did a design. So it's kind of interesting to watch. I mean, I think Apple has a small black eye. It's been going on since they lost the phone in the bar. That this has been a somewhat cursed rollout, but I think, you know, they'll still make a few billion dollars off of it, and no one's worried about Steve Jobs' next meal.
So the question, though, is how big a deal is this anyway? I was reading an interesting report, Tim, in videonews.com yesterday saying that this story in some ways is a bit of a creation of the media, that there has been so much reporting. Obviously, we know there's just a fascination with Apple in general. But what Video News said is that in most of the stories, there were very few actual iPhone 4 customers who were complaining about the problem. What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I kind of think it's a non-story story. I mean, here we are talking about the media and what they're reporting. So usually when you're covering the media and what the media is doing, there's not really a story there. But that said, I have an iPhone 4. It's a great device. I'm an Apple fanboy. I love it to death. And occasionally I forget and I hold it the wrong way and I drop a call. There's a really easy fix is just put some Scotch tape over the little endings or, you know, a piece of tape that'll fix the problem right off the bat. And it's such an elegant phone. Otherwise, it's a shame that it's having this problem. But for me, what I was really excited to see, I mean, sure, it was great to see the phone early and when it was, you know, left behind and this whole antenna thing stinks, but we got to see those really cool rooms where they do the testing of the phone. And it's amazing. How cool would it be to see the French maids bouncing on all that foam in that big room? That would just be so fun. I want to shoot there so bad.
Oh, we have to work on that. That will never happen, but that would just be fantastic because it is just pure, beautiful tech geek porn, isn't it? That testing chamber.
Especially the Stargate.
Exactly. So I think that's fair to say that it's funny. My husband has been in the media business for a long time too, and he always says, you know, when the media starts reporting on the media, you know, we've all turned cannibals, which is true. This is a bit of a cannibalistic story, but at the same time, I think it's interesting as kind of a business case, and as David had said, you know, as he's somebody who's been a communications strategist, is how do you handle something like this? And it's just Lon, I just think it's interesting that he chose to kind of throw other cell phone makers under the bus too, and say, well, every cell phone has problems.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I often wonder, too, what Apple would be like if it had a Twitter account like Comcast has, you know, where they can acknowledge every fault every 25 seconds of the day and try to address them. You know, Apple really prides itself on ultimate secrecy, which is so unusual in this day and age now where everything is so becoming so much more transparent and that there's so many terrible things that can happen to a company for not being immediately on an issue like they were. I thought Steve handled himself very well in the press conference. And to some degree, too, I think perhaps the media may feel like, hey, we've given Apple too much here. I mean, I went to the – unfortunately, had to sit online for a little bit to go pick up my phone on launch day because I just couldn't possibly wait. And there were two live news trucks outside – and they weren't mine because we don't have that budget yet. There were two live news trucks outside the Apple store when I walked up to it. How many other products launch with that kind of attention? And perhaps maybe the media felt like, geez, we gave these guys too much of a free ride here. We've got to report the lowering of these ultimately unreachable expectations.
I just wanted to say that Apple does have a Twitter feed. It's Steve Jobs' random emails to
people. Right, that's true.
That's true. That's his Twitter feed. So
that's true. That's a good point.
Particularly with the uptake that those things get once somebody gets them and they share them with everybody else. It's just a back door to Twitter.
Right. It's a brilliant strategy, actually.
I have to say, as folks know, I'm using a Mac computer. I'm not an iPhone person. I'm very happy with my Android cell phone, though. There are other options. Don't forget that. It's actually a really cool phone. I've been using a lot more of the functionality, but, you know, it's not perfect. Sometimes the calls drop. Usually if the calls drop, it's because I'm a dork and I hit the end button by mistake. Speaking of Google, an interesting story in eWeek saying that Google is entertaining interactive video ads, entertaining being kind of playing around with this, that Eric Schmidt says Google is experimenting with interactive video ads as a break from the traditional search and banner ads, obviously, that have, you know, made Google a huge success financially and on the web. It's experimenting with video, mobile, other types of ads in an effort to attract consumers' attention. Interesting, tying this back to cell phones, I downloaded a horoscope app just for fun on my Android phone, and you're constantly seeing these Google ads on it. So I'm definitely getting some of these additional mobile ads that they're talking about. But the thing that I always think when it comes to Google, I'm going to start with David on this, is that this is a company obviously that has done phenomenally well in search and with search ads, but has really struggled at a lot of the other businesses that has tried beyond that. What do you think about the potential of these other type of ads?
Well, I've been hearing about interactive ads on video, I think, since, Daisy, you were two. And I know you're only 20 now and quite precocious for your age. However, it's been going on a long time. I mean, I remember all the stink over interactive TV ads in a pizza joint deal up in the Bay Area. An American Film Institute was doing these workshops. And, you know, it's been something that's been sort of chugging along for a long time. And I still haven't seen anybody getting too excited about it. But at least it makes sense on an interactive platform, a truly interactive platform like a computer, where we're used to doing that, or even now a smartphone. We're used to having a back and forth. So, you know, it's nice that they're doing it. They're trying to figure out some way to make more money. I just don't think it's going to be gigantic, huge, oh my God money, which is what what Google needs to be able to move the dial for them in any way that's going to excite investors. They're becoming a mature business, and they're so big that they people looking at their quarterly results are going to be bored now, because they're not going to get those 10%, 15% growth rates quarter over quarter over quarter. They just can't do it. They're too big. The base is too large, and this won't make that much of a difference either. The needle's just not going to move very much, I don't think.
Tim, what do you think? Is Google a mature company? I mean, there was an interesting story in TechCrunch that addressed this, the whole idea of, is Google at risk of becoming the next Microsoft, that it's played around with these different ideas, that it's acquired these companies. But at the end of the day, is there much innovation that's left? I mean, it's actually lost, the company has lost a number of sort of its early entrepreneurs.
Oh, hold on a second. I was clicking on Jennifer Aniston's sweater.
These interactive videos.
I've been trying to buy that thing for 10 years now. You know, I mean, the interesting thing about interactive advertising, I mean, even if you go back to the early days of banner ads, when they first came out, they had phenomenal click-through rates because people said, oh, what is this? I must click on it and see where it takes me. And I think the same thing's going to happen in the interactive video ad space. You know, at first there's going to be a higher click-through rate. Like, you know, in the mobile video app world, Nissan has an electric car called the Leaf. And a lot of people are clicking on that ad not because they want to buy an electric car, but because they want to see this interactive advertising that's going on with the Nissan Leaf. And they have it's a really interesting ad that pauses the app, brings up video, plays video, and it's interactive video that lets you take a tour of the electric car. But is it going to move the needle on buying the cars? I don't know.
The people are just clicking on that because it's fun and interesting and different, but not because they're in the market for a new Nissan.
Right. And it goes back to the basics. You know, if you're going to create something that's interactive, that's great, but is it relevant to the person that's looking at it? Are they in the market for it? Are you getting in front of the right person? And is the creative emotionally stimulating? And that's, you know, Apple's really working hard on that with the iAd. I don't know if Google is. How emotional has Google been? I mean, you can argue that the Google website, where they have the different things that they bring up, like when they had Pac-Man on their homepage, that's an emotional thing. So there are these glimpses of where Google is not a Microsoft, where they do have fun and they play with their homepage. So I do think there is opportunity there. It's a big machine though, it's hard to change the course of an aircraft carrier.
Lon, what is your take on Google and where it stands right now? Is it a risk of becoming the next Microsoft, or is this kind of solid, steady product line really a good thing?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're an investor, I think having something with no surprises, steady profit, and just a very, you know, very firm set of products that work well is never a bad thing. But, you know, you also look at Microsoft's, some of their recent success, most particular the Xbox, which is a really cool product. And who would have thought that the same company that makes Microsoft Office and SQL Server could actually do something as cool as the Xbox would? And part of it was they almost created a Skunk Works that kind of went off on their own, you know, with some money that and developed a really, you know, really neat product. And maybe that's where Google needs to go here, is really, you know, focus on, you know, maintaining the mature product line that they have in search and Gmail and some of the other things, but also empowering employees beyond the 20% time to go off and start something that's kind of different. You know, we're seeing AOL do it now also with Patch and a few other things that they're trying. So perhaps that's the path that Google needs to take and be the best of both worlds. But, you know, they also need to pay, I think, more to their partners who are putting their ads up.
Now, quick aside, we've talked about Google TV on this show before. David, since we haven't had you on a little bit, what's your take on Google TV? If you were a betting man, is that going to succeed or fail?
Well, first thing, what counts as a success? Again, I'll go back to the fact that it is a really big ship, and Google TV might be cool, might be nice, but it's not going to transform Google again. Google's had its home run, and Android and the Droid operating system or Android operating system may become something, but I don't know that Google TV by itself is a transformative product. It seems to me it's kind of an add-on to some extent. It's interesting, but not overwhelming to me. So, I mean, I'll wait and see, but I just am not expecting that one to be a home run.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see that there's a great need or desire for it. Let's talk about YouTube briefly, because interesting story from All Things D, from Media Memo, Peter Kafka wrote, is YouTube still a money pit? It was about a year ago when the Google CFO predicted that YouTube could be very profitable in the quote, not long too long distance future, which is sort of an interesting play on words. But now it's a year later, and I don't think that Google has announced that YouTube is profitable. Certainly every time you go to the homepage, you will see an ad there, usually for a big movie that's being released or some kind of video game or entertainment play. So there's obviously advertising dollars that are coming into YouTube. But if we're going to speculate, and what do we think? How is YouTube doing? Is it making money? What do you think, Tim? You're close to YouTube in the sense that obviously you're participating in it.
Yeah, I think one of the things we talked about on last week's show was that there was a terms of service change on YouTube to where if you have a website that's just scraping videos off YouTube, putting them on your site, and monetizing with banner ads or other ads, that they're going to cut you off. And to me, that seems like a move that somebody would make if they didn't need that distribution anymore. And it feels like with that change of terms of service, they're reeling things in. So it feels like, yeah, maybe they are moving towards profitability just based on that.
Well, okay, so you're saying so this change could suggest that sort of the whatever incremental revenue that they might have been getting, they don't actually need because they're doing better in other areas?
I'm thinking they may be doing better in other areas, and they're pulling things in, and they're going to tighten the reins, and they're going to go after, you know, more of the spammy type people and kind of cut them out of the loop.
Cleaning up their act. Lon, what do you think? How is YouTube doing?
I think, from the standpoint of eyeballs, I do believe they're still ahead of Facebook, if I'm not mistaken, on site views and whatnot. So clearly they have no problem there. The problem, again, comes back to being able to find a way to make these things profitable and making also a deal for the publishers too. And what's interesting is when you look at a competitor like Blip.tv, which I think pays more to producers for, you know, their ad share than YouTube does, it's going to be a difficult challenge for them to just make money on the ads inside the video alone. And I'm sure Tim's got some thoughts on that too. So I don't know. I mean, it's clearly a service I use every day. I'm on there all the time. The ads are not too annoying just yet, but they have to show some, you know, profit and some revenue from all these people looking at it. And I think there's going to be a lot of investor pressure to get them there as well. So I think that policy change is one of those things that they'll have to do.
David, is Google feeling pressure? And do you think it will be able to pull this off and show Wall Street that it was a smart investment?
I think they're definitely feeling pressure. I think, to me, the area where they feel the pressure is that we are probably, in my assessment, in the middle of another epochal shift in the way people are using the internet. We're evolving from an era of search-driven connection to one of a social media-driven connection. So how do you do something with YouTube? Well, you figure out a way to connect that even more fully into a broader social media space. And people are finding things now through social media recommendations and connections from their friends and their quasi-friends less than they are typing into the Google page. And so, you know, one of the things I've seen, you know, Facebook is at 500 million as of this week, I think, 500 million users. Most of that activity is largely invisible to Google, and it's where people are finding videos they care about. They're finding music they care about. They're talking about restaurants and causes and things that are happening in their day, and they're connecting to people and family and sharing photos. And that's largely invisible to Google. And that's why Google's so desperate to try and figure out social media, because they've had, what, three shots at that, and they've had three whiffs. And so now they've got the Google Me initiative that's super secret and is supposed to save their bacon in this area. They need to figure out something, because that's where stuff is going. And
their previous social media initiatives have been – they've gone too far. They've been a little bit too invasive, a little bit too presumptive, I think, from a user point of view. I mean, that was the big problem with Google Buzz. Don't turn that on for me.
Right.
They forced it down everyone's throat.
Yeah.
I mean, they pushed that down everybody's throat. I mean, to some extent, it's the engineer Uber Alles mindset. And, you know, one of the conversations, one of the pieces that we shared before the call was, you know, the growth of a monoculture in any big organization. I mean, behavioral psychologists and organizational behavior psychologists would have a field day with where Google is right now. They've gotten very big. They have that very elite culling system to figure out who they let in the door as an employee, but that tends to encourage a certain monoculture that I don't think is necessarily like the rest of us. And some of that's good, and some of that I think will end up biting them in the butt, particularly in a social media world where there are a wide variety of people accessing. So, yeah, they are definitely feeling pressure, and they should feel pressure. They've got some shifts going on underneath their feet.
Do they need to have a social media play themselves, or do they need to do what they do so well, which is search, and apply that to social, which is obviously what Google has started to do already with real-time search results that it started implementing last year with surfacing tweets and whatnot? Does that help this social issue?
Well, I think it does, and I actually think that the Twitter deal was a smart deal that they needed to make, and I think that they really ought to figure out I don't know that Facebook will let them do it, because there's nothing in Facebook's interest about making that happen. You know, Facebook is a big enough gorilla of its own now that it doesn't need Google. Google should have done that deal 3 years ago.
Good point. David, you had an interesting field trip this weekend to the Disney lot at 3D University. What is that? Tell us about that. You learned a lot about 3D technologies for TV and film.
Right. This weekend, the International Society, International 3D Society, and the Entertainment Technology Center over at USC's Film School put on a 3D University, which was a day long kind of conversation with some of the top guys who are creating 3D content in film, animation, TV, and sports. And there were some really great talks there about some of the challenges and opportunities that are going on in this space. I mean, right now we are in the middle of an explosion of technologies to actually do things with 3D. This is the third round of 3D mania. We had one in the 50s and one in the 80s, and again, we're 30 years later, and it's time to do it again, I guess. But what we're seeing is a big bump in interest as studios and theaters try to give people a reason to get out of their home theater systems and go to the multiplex. But at the same time, the consumer electronics companies are coming out now with, I think, about 20-odd models of home TV systems and Blu-ray capable disc players that can do 3D. And we now have a number of laptops that are 3D capable. So there are going to be lots of ways to access 3D, but creating content in a 3D space is very different from what people have done in the 2D space. I had lunch with a guy who's busy writing a book, and one of the things we talked about was during the 3DU, they showed a shot that wouldn't be that big a deal in a 2D film, camera kind of dollying in over somebody's shoulder to another figure. But because of the way 3D is, that looking over that person's shoulder completely screws with your head, and you've got to do some very sophisticated tweaking to manage the way people pop out of the screen on the one hand, and then the main subject of the shot, who's past the person whose shoulder you're looking over, doesn't disappear. So you've got to treat 3D, the plane of convergence, as they call it, in different ways. It's one of the things you wouldn't expect. And so the guy that I was having lunch with said, in 2D, we figured out a whole bunch of visual vocabulary. Guys like Orson Welles and Sergei Eisenstein and D.W. Griffiths figured out a way to tell a story and use the limitations of 2D to depict what was going on in a 3D volumetric space. Well, now we've got a 3D way to represent that stuff. We have to figure out a new visual vocabulary, and that's part of what we're trying to do right now.
And that is so fascinating. I love that idea of a visual vocabulary. And I think, Tim, for somebody such as yourself, you're a content creator. I don't know that you're making anything in 3D at the moment. But as you think about it, and just sort of the small and the large issues of shots and setting up and what works and what doesn't work. What are the things that kind of tantalize you about 3D and that concern you?
Have you seen Jennifer Aniston's sweater in 3D?
Now you can really, in 3D, you can really buy it.
Just want to click on it. 3D, I used to work in a 3D movie theater when I was in college at Epcot. It's 3D is a pain in the butt. It's interesting because, as a content person, a lot of people are excited about 3D. They think it's cool. They want to be on the cutting edge. To me, it's really about the story. Do you need it to be 3D? Is there a compelling reason for the story to be done in 3D? Does it make sense, or is it just a gimmick? How can you organically bring 3D into what you're doing? Now, for a football game, I think that might be fun to watch a football game in 3D or a soccer match in 3D. A lot of people did that during the World Cup, went to different venues where they could see it in 3D. But that language of creating in 3D is not fully developed. And the other thing, I'm scratching my head about 3D, and people have wanted it to work for so long. There have been so many people that I've seen at conferences for the last 10 years that have been pushing this rock up the hill, and now it really has momentum. But yet, why? Is it to get people back into the movie theater? Well, the studios are competing against themselves if they're going to do it on TV as well as the theater. And it seems like it kind of just leaves the theater chains out in the cold.
I saw Despicable Me a couple of weeks ago, which was in 3D, and cute movie. I don't know why it needed to be in 3D. I wasn't sold that the experience was so much better with 3D. So I think it's still a ways to go. Final question on this, and I'm looking at some of the notes David shared with me in advance. I want to toss this over to Lon to get his take on it. But David, you had said that you know, one of the big issues, obviously, is with 3D and with the growth and uptake will be glasses, having to use glasses. But that some of the speakers talked about that it might be possible to kind of have a glasses-free 3D on big screens. And before I toss this to Lon, David, I mean, how would that work?
Well, right now we've got, there are several technologies that require glasses, and that's a big pain in the rear. It's a big obstacle. It's one of the substantial obstacles to 3D uptake. You got to spend, for an active shutter, a pair of glasses, $150. It only, the ones from one manufacturer will work on TVs from that manufacturer, but may not work on the TVs from another manufacturer. That's a big consumer headache. It's a lot of confusion. It's not ideal. The new technologies, there's a couple things you can do right now. You can create a 3D-only TV screen. The resolution's not super high, so you can see. It looks like you're looking through a screen door, but it looks good for what it is. I saw they had a nice 35-inch or so 3D-only screen in the lobby of the 3DU. On a small screen like the 3DS, the handheld Nintendo game machine, they're going to have a 3D screen. The small screen can do it because it's a single viewer. There's one sweet spot. You know about how far away that sweet spot's going to be, a couple feet away from you, arm's length. And you can do a 3D experience there. That's pretty good. But the question is, can you do a screen that is both 2D and 3D capable, depending on what you're watching, and looks good for more than one person? And the most interesting thing, three companies have had announcements in the last 6 weeks, we'll say. The most important and interesting one was Microsoft, which would allow their technology says that you could see two people could see a 3D image without glasses, or four people could see a 2D image without a problem with their technology. Now, the experts were saying we didn't know how long it would be before something would come along. These three announcements push that thing forward. It's still kind of an unknown about when it will be, but it's a lot more likely to happen soon, within 5 years maybe, than it was before. They were thinking 15 or more years before that.
So, Lon, do you think that will make a difference? I mean, is that sort of removing one of the big barriers in time to 3D uptake?
Absolutely, because the technology is certainly getting better for consumers, at least. And from the movies theater standpoint, I agree with you. I don't think every movie needs to be 3D. Clearly, Avatar was – I had people raving to me about going – I have never actually saw the movie yet, but how great it was in 3D, but other movies not so much. But on the consumer side especially, because I see that really – the glasses thing is really the turnoff for me. I feel like this is really the manufacturer is trying to find a market for something rather than entering into an area where there really is some consumer demand, and taking away the need to have glasses on is going to make a huge difference. The glasses have been kind of there since the beginning, obviously, of 3D. I remember having a Sega Master System in like 1987 that had shutter based glasses, and it was a really cool gimmick until I got headaches from it, and that was it. And I stopped playing with it. I felt like I was damaging my brain or something. So, I just want a holodeck that they had on Star Trek.
Yeah, right. Hello. Wouldn't that just make everything so much easier? You know what I would do if I had a holodeck? I would teleport to the old Spice Guy. That's what I would do if I had a holodeck.
Hey, you know what, though? Japan promised if they get the next, the 2022 World Cup, that they'll show the games in holographs.
Ooh.
They just announced that. But I do want to say the sports is one of the areas where 3D is amazing. So they showed some stuff from the big January 1st hockey game. Steve Schlaer from 3Ality showed this beauty reel of his stuff. And the hockey in 3D was incredible. And another guy, I'm doing some work on a 3D TV project right now, full disclosure, and one of the guys who's an investor in this project did Halo in 3D. And of course, the games are video games are created in 3D, right? So it's not a big deal. It's just an issue of can you display it? They're already in a 3D space. He says, and when you're playing a video game in 3D, it is a completely compelling, overwhelming experience.
Yeah, that must be pretty incredible. That must be almost as incredible as being in the same room as the Old Spice Guy. See, I'm going to try to make that transition again. We're going to talk about Old Spice. What a fantastic viral marketing campaign. I just, yeah, full disclosure, I loved it. That I just thought this campaign was brilliant. If you don't know about it, basically started with a Super Bowl ad. TWIM listeners may recall it's an ad that Alex's wife was particularly fond of. So when Alex is on the show, we'll often talk about how much she enjoyed the ad. I enjoyed the ad. I don't know any woman who didn't enjoy the ad. Beautiful, beautiful ad. But anyway, so it turned into this whole viral thing last week where Wieden and Kennedy, the creative agency working with Procter & Gamble's Old Spice, put together almost like a real-time campaign, a viral marketing campaign, really responding to tweets and to messages and creating these new videos and ads for Old Spice on the fly, a lot of them in response to very influential tweeters, Ellen DeGeneres, Kevin Rose, Demi Moore, Perez Hilton, and so on. I just think that it was really clever. I think the issue is, though, is this going to change the fortunes for a brand like Old Spice? Who knows? But it was interesting to try. Tim, what was your take on this? Were you following it?
Alyssa Milano.
Yes, she got involved too.
She got it. Not only did she get involved, she got in a towel and stood in her bathroom and did a video for the Old Spice man. It was great. It was great. She was asking people to support the Wildlife Foundation and help out the animals that have been injured by the oil spill, which I thought was a good use of it. But amazing campaign at last week at LA TV Fest. Everyone was talking about this during the conference, and you know, Kevin Rose was sick, and the Old Spice man asked him to get well, and I mean, it was just so brilliant how almost in real time they were turning around really, really funny responses to what people were tweeting about the Old Spice guy. And I saw the Old Spice guy, the actor that plays him, Isaiah Mustafa, I think is his name. He was on G4's, one of their, it might have been Attack of the Show or one of their shows, and they interviewed him about doing the whole commercial and about that process. And this was before they did this. And even before, it was just that commercial is visually engaging, and it's funny and it's clever. And then to roll this on top of it and have this interactivity, I think it raises the bar for everyone, not only in the advertising space, but in the programming space of you can't talk with everyone in your audience, but if you can talk with key individuals that other people follow in your audience, that's huge.
I so agree. I mean, it just says what is possible with advertising. I mean, there's so much talk, you know, on this show and other places, obviously, about, you know, what makes a good ad, and most ads aren't watchable. And this was, you know, just pure entertainment in and of itself, as well as an ad unfolding before our eyes. And you're right. I think this does up the game for a lot of other marketers.
I wonder if it'll sell any more product.
Well, yes, I think that is. Well, look, I went out and bought Old Spice for my husband. I feel like, you know, you got to reward. In a way, I got to reward them for that. Just provided so much entertainment for myself. You know, will I become a regular purchaser of it for him? You know, we'll see. That definitely remains to be seen. Lon, lessons learned for other marketers.
Well, clearly you need a good-looking guy who can ride a horse. and now what I found intriguing about this ad was that, as my wife said, I'm already as good-looking and I smell as good as him. So, you know, clearly I didn't have a need for the product. But the geek in me was like, how the heck did they do that? Leo's got a great interview with the creators about the first ad and how long it took and that it was shot, I believe, in a single take. So it's clearly just a fascinating production process just from that standpoint. But I think marketers, you know, have something to learn that you can really, you know, do an all-inclusive campaign where perhaps you gain that initial thrust of viewership through something like a Super Bowl ad or some other, you know, high audience-driven medium, and then extract more value out of that marketing campaign, you know, by doing these viral videos that are really hitting the younger demographic with presumably a greater disposable income. Just think about how inexpensive it was to put the guy in a towel and point a video camera at him and get millions of views out of it. It was just fantastic. And I do need to look up the Alyssa Milano video. I didn't see that.
David, is this Susan Boyle, i.e. something that's, you know, lightning strikes once, but you can't really replicate it? Or do you think it is something that other marketers can duplicate and or make their own?
Well, the way I would look at the Old Spice thing, the last little sort of sweatshop process over 2 days that they did was really brilliant and highly compact, very affordable for what they spent. You think about what a major brand spends to get out content, whether it's on a media buy on the Super Bowl or whatever. They probably spent, you know, say $100,000 for 2 days of work, a couple hundred thousand, you know, and their bang for the buck was remarkable. But I think that what you really need to look at is this is part of a broader reconstruction of a very old brand. And they've been working at it for a couple of 3 years now in a very savvy, funny way. And this is just sort of the cherry on top, and it's a really brilliant cherry. But Old Spice was your dad's or your grandfather's brand for a long time, and nobody knew was going to use Old Spice. I mean, it was old, and they have become much hipper and much funnier for quite some time now and made that brand much more accessible. Now, I think going forward, it's absolutely this is a little bit of lightning in a bottle, but I think there are lessons there. And as Tim said, you know, they are connecting to specific members of the audience, some of whom are well-known, some of whom are not. Those particularly well-known members of the audience who are responding and asking, you know, getting engaged, become amplifiers for the brand and ambassadors for the brand. That's exactly what you want to do. So to me, I think there's a lot of really good, solid lessons here that can be duplicated. But again, what they did was part of a broader multi-year strategy to revive an aging brand.
Which is, I think it's a great thing to remember for the marketers and folks in advertising who listen to our show, that, you know, that something like this has the potential to work because there is an overarching strategy behind it. This strategy didn't just start a week ago in Portland when Wieden and Kenny said, let's just try something really new and cool and different. You know, it's been going on for a while. And that's important to keep in mind. Now, speaking of social networking and social advertising, just read an interesting brief little report here on Digital Media Wire that said that social networks like Facebook and MySpace, you know, account for more than 1/5 of all U.S. advertising traffic, but are bringing in the lowest rates for their ads and may have dragged down the average online CPM by as much as 18% over the past year. I guess that came from an Ad Age story. And the Comscore data is saying that that the CPM is 56 cents compared to the $2.43 seen on non-social network sites. Interesting. It makes me think, Tim, are social networks the lowest common denominator for advertising?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people talk about MySpace and how the people that are on MySpace are of a lower socioeconomic, educational, every demographic you can think of. They're on the low end. And they also talk about how click-through advertising, people who are less educated and have a less income usually click on sponsored ads as opposed to people who are more educated don't click on those ads. And in the social network universe, I think that's a great opportunity for somebody who wants to target those lower income people. You know, it's you can get some good real estate right there at bargain basement prices. Unfortunately, it is running down the rates for the rest of us, and I think that's why a lot of people are moving to videos and putting videos on their site, and then also mobile video as well, where you're looking at CPMs that instead of in the pennies or the low dollars are, you know, $40-$50 CPMs, and as much as $100 CPMs in some cases if it's highly targeted content that you're advertising against.
Interesting. Let's segue into another story about social media advertising before we wrap things up. This is actually more social media marketing. You know, and a lot of folks will write to me, listeners will say, okay, you know, we talk about social media on this show and Twitter, but if I'm starting a new podcast or a new video show or whatever it is, how can I really truly use it to my advantage? And of course, the whole point is, you know, look, it's an investment. If you're starting a show, if you're starting a podcast, a media project, you're going to have to, you know, build an audience. And you're not going to find your followers from day one. There's sort of a methodical building of the audience over time and reaching out to like-minded blogs, like-minded producers, and so on. So I just kind of wanted to address that quickly that a listener had asked me about, and we can talk about that, continue to talk about that on other shows. But this interesting report on from TechCrunch that talked about how social media drives new businesses. Obviously, we hear about what big brands are doing. Starbucks, Virgin, Levi's, it's Old Spice, obviously, since we just talked about that. But that there are smaller, more local businesses that are doing this as well. And this story talked about this creme brulee cart in San Francisco. That this guy operates a creme brulee cart, has amassed over 12,000 Twitter followers in about a year, and a lot of his business is coming now from people who follow him on Twitter, because apparently Twitter is the only way you can find the cart's location for the day. That's a really interesting use of Twitter. You know, it's kind of a, you have to be in the know, but it's obviously something, you know, it's a product that has a certain, you know, cachet kind of interest to it. What do you guys think about that? Alon, I mean, you're in the local business. I mean, what is, does that, how could you use Twitter, or how could businesses use Twitter in that fashion to grow their business, as this gentleman who runs the creme brulee cart has done?
Sure. Well, you know, we use it quite a bit, especially for sourcing news stories. But in addition to also finding out, you know, a lot of new businesses, when they first get going in a community, tend to, you know, get the Facebook page put up, get the Twitter page going. So we're always on the lookout for them, both for story ideas, but also for the opportunity to solicit some advertising sales as well. And to some degree, some of these Facebook pages that have been forming have almost become competitors, in a sense that, you know, a local restaurant can easily amass as many Facebook followers as we might have on a local news site in the same community. So do they need us at that point? And that's why we're focusing on video for localonlinenews.tv, because that is a different way to get a message out that people will almost have to watch when it starts playing. So, you know, we're seeing just a tremendous amount of local businesses in the communities that we cover, you know, flocking to Facebook, and at the expense, I think, of newspaper advertising and online advertising. We're having, you know, it's tough to get people to part with their money, especially for new technology. And if they can put a thing up for free, they often do that first. Another point that I have found interesting with Facebook, as we're launching in some small communities, is that the amount of people that you can target is getting smaller and smaller, to the point now where we have some towns in my area alone that have maybe 2,500 people in them, which you can now target a Facebook ad into that single little community. It used to be more of a regional buy, or to a larger community. In the last few months, they've actually allowed you to get even more granular, which is really fascinating. Costs a little bit more, but you can really get it laser beamed down to a very small target now. And a lot of local businesses are finding that attractive, mainly because the CPM is so low.
David, what sort of small businesses do you think can benefit from Twitter, as the creme brulee man has?
Well, you know, it's interesting, because the creme brulee guy is a San Francisco manifestation of a slightly different trend in Los Angeles, where a year and a half ago, a guy named Roy Choi, a chef who had worked at various prominent restaurants in town, was between gigs. He and a partner bought a taco truck, started doing, because Roy is Korean, started mixing Korean meats with Mexican tacos and other stuff to make the Kogi beef truck. They paired that up with Twitter and created essentially a vast food trend here, where we've got fleets of food trucks serving all kinds of wacky hybrid cuisines, and people connect with them based on Twitter. And now there are sort of meta pages that aggregate multiple Twitter feeds from the food trucks. They have food truck events where, you know, 15, 20, 30 trucks are all gathered together, and hundreds or thousands of people show up and buy food from the food trucks. And they're part of now the street scene in Los Angeles. It's really been a transformational thing. But it also works for lots of other small businesses. The challenge is that small businesses don't have the bandwidth to either A, tend to a whole bunch of different social media platforms, or B, hire somebody else to do it for them. So what they really need to do, and what I tell, like, I got a great little French restaurant down the street, and the couple that owns it, I've kind of given them some advice. You know, pick two or three of these things that make sense for you. Set up some appointment times where you effectively are setting aside time to spend 15 to 30 minutes a few times a week focused on this. And then do it in a slow, incremental way. Understand it's going to be a slow build. So for a restaurant, I mean, I think that Twitter's nice. I think that probably better are these location-based services like Foursquare in particular, where you can give little deals, special deals to people who come in multiple times, people, whoever's the mayor. You've got to pay attention to Yelp. And I think for a lot of service industries, Yelp has now become very important. So you've got to make sure that people aren't savaging you inappropriately. But you really need to just kind of be a rifle, not a shotgun. Be focused and understand it's a slow incremental build.
Speaking of social networking, of course, you should all become friends of TWIM on our Facebook page. It's an important thing to do. We want to be friends with all of our listeners. David, where can people find you online?
David Bloom is on Twitter. It's David BLOOM, and you can find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook, of course. And I have Bloomsday, my blog, it's on my Apple page. So
we'll find you on Twitter. We'll find you on Twitter.
Tim,
where do you want people to find you?
You can find me on Twitter at 1TimStreet. And if you're interested in mobile video, mdialogue.com.
Excellent. Lon, where do you want people to find you?
You can Twitter me at LonSeidman. And you can check out our local news site, localonlinenews.tv.
Excellent. And of course, I'm at DaisyWhitney.com and on Twitter at DaisyWhitney. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.